The Glenn Show is brought to you by the Manhattan Institute and by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for all you do. Your contribution allows us to produce The Glenn Show week after week, along with all of the other great content at glennlowry.substack.com. Your contribution also helps to fund grassroots initiatives that empower Black development across the country as we donate 10% of our profits to the Woodson Center. Once again, thank you.
Hello, all. Welcome to The Glenn Show. I am John McWhorter, and I am guest hosting for Glenn Lowry while he is happily on the mend. And what we're going to do today is we're going to pretend that it's Glenn and me, except it isn't, because it's me and Clifton Duncan. And we're going to have a conversation about some crucial issues. Clifton Duncan is an actor. Clifton Duncan is a podcaster. Clifton Duncan is an experienced performer who has had a stage career over much of the United States, including here in New York City. And Clifton Duncan is someone who finds himself out of step with certain received opinions and would like to talk about these things with us. I was particularly interested in Clifton at this point because he is planning a one-man show about none other than Tom Sowell, who is, of course, a hero of Glenn's and a hero of mine, very much a North Star. And Clifton, I wanted to ask you as we open, why Sowell and why theater as a medium for it?
Well, it's been an idea that I've had for a few years now. And, you know, like back in 1977, James Earl Jones did a play called Robeson, which is about the great Paul Robeson. About 10 years ago, Larry Fishburne did a play called Thurgood, which is about Thurgood Marshall, another one-man show. And around the same time, you might have seen this show, John, but a wonderful actor named John Douglas Thompson did a play called Satchmo at the Waldorf off-Broadway about Louis Armstrong.
He's amazing. One-man show. I didn't see it. Yeah.
Yeah. John is a great, great actor, great guy. And, you know, I just said to myself, what could be a one-man show that that I might be able to create and perform myself? And I discovered Tom Sowell on a YouTube rabbit hole many, many years ago. And I was like, who is this man with this this chocolate skin, these glasses, and the most perfect afro you've ever seen?
Always.
Just completely, yeah. Always. Just, you know, the lion's mane. Just completely, just clinically, calmly, acerbically, wryly, taking on these, what you called received opinions, very effectively. I mean, I sent a clip of him on the Bill Buckley show to my progressive friend. And he was like, I find Sowell's arguments to be very compelling. But even beyond the stature that he's gained, especially in conservative-leaning circles, I just think that he is a fascinating person who's lived a fascinating life. This is someone who was born in 1930. He's experienced segregation and Jim Crow, but he's also experienced progressive racism. And he's also someone who, for the first 30 years of his life, thought of the world in one way and was, I'll say, forced in a way to change his opinion when he encountered new evidence to challenge those assertions. He's also someone that I'm discovering is sort of a man against the machine. There's a common theme in his life, and if you read his memoirs, this comes to the fore, where he's someone who has always been at odds, whether it's public schooling when he was a child, to him being in the Marines as a young adult, to him being in academia as an older adult. He's always been someone who has been very uncompromising, someone who always stood for excellence, strove for excellence, and made sure that he held everyone else to as high a standard as he held himself. There's something, I just think he's a really compelling person. But the funny thing about that is that now that I'm preparing a show about him, I have to detach myself in a way and my personal feelings about him to try and create and understand the character of Thomas Sowell so that I can interpret him as an actor in the way that Clifton Duncan would portray Thomas Sowell.
Are you going to imitate him? Are you coming up with Clifton Duncan's Tom Sowell voice and mannerisms? That's an interesting challenge.
It is an interesting challenge, because what you don't want to do is you don't want to descend into SNL style impersonation. No. What you want to do is embody that person, the essence of that person, as much as possible. Sowell's really interesting because he has a unique, I don't know if you call it a dialect specifically, but it's a bit of Southern. He was born in North Carolina, but it's tinged with, you can hear the New York in his voice.
Very much.
Very much so. What you want to do is you want to, as much as possible, internalize and personalize and incorporate the sort of external aspects about himself and repurpose it through my own body, my own voice. Because the trap is that if you become fixated on these external things, then you miss what's underneath. And that's what people really want to see anyway.
So, you know what? Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, just to answer your question succinctly, yes and no.
Something you might want to know that I'm not sure comes across in the clips if you're doing him is that in real life, he's a little bit more vigorous with bodily movement while he talks than he is on TV. He's given to going like this, and he will go like this. That's the way he moves from up here, which you don't know if you're sitting with a microphone and sitting in a seat. He's a passionate speaker in real life. That's something that I found interesting when I actually met him.
Well, I love that you said that too, because I think people think of him as an intellectual. When you think of the intellect, you think of the mind and someone who lives in their head. But what I get from him is, like you said, a very passionate, really a very fiery man. Mm-hmm. He's got a lot of fire inside him, a lot of passion inside him, which is then translated into his words. And he's got a way of kind of cutting you down or getting the point across in very few words, very harshly, very pointedly, but not necessarily like raising his voice or getting into these kinds of things. But, you know, people have asked me like, well, how are you going to do it? Because he does mostly interviews. I'm like, well, he's a human being. You know, like, there literally are stories of him. You know, he writes about how he's, you know, fighting with like homeless people on the trains. And you know, he's not averse, or he wasn't averse when he was younger to a scrap, be that with ideas or physical. So, you know, that's what's so interesting about it, because once you begin to do a deep dive and you do the discovery process, I mean, I had the great Zelda Fitchandler, who was one of my teachers, who you may know, she once said that information is inspiration. So right now it's all about filling myself up with as much information as possible. And that's going to help fire up my intuition. And what I am sure I will find over time is that once I internalize everything correctly, I want to get so good that I can improvise as him.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right. Like that would be the bee's knees, basically. If we can still say that, the old slang.
The cat. You know, he told me so once, swell. Actually, this, I don't know if this can fit into your piece, but he said that he thinks he met W.E.B. Du Bois. He said that when he was little, he was in that building in Harlem that Du Bois lived in, and a man came out of the elevator who he was introduced to, who was treated with great reverence. And in his memory, he thinks that he met Du Bois, but he's not sure because he was too young to know who it was. But you can tell he did. So there's that little spark. And that's a nice bit of his story.
Well, also, one wonders that if he did meet Du Bois, if his esteem for Du Bois, if there was any, was diminished by the fact that Du Bois is a Harvard graduate. And also, can I just ask, is it Du Bois or is it Du Bois? Are we just saying Du Bois because he's Black American, or is it Du Bois?
It was Du Bois. And I know that not only because that's how everybody says it. Well, this is, I think. My first girlfriend from like 400 years ago ended up marrying, how did this go? Ended up marrying a man much older than her whose grandmother went to school with Du Bois. The grandmother a white woman of Great Barrington said of Du Bois that he was, quote unquote, uppity. That was the memory. Yes. And in recalling that, the man, her grandson, said Du Bois. But then again, maybe he had picked that up from the fact that he's celebrated in Great Barrington. That's my little connection with my own connection with Du Bois. But I think it was Du Bois. I've never heard anybody say it any other way, including in older clips. But yeah, not Du Bois. Oh, by the way, Clifton, should we mention that? Are you still doing the? Are you still soliciting donations for your piece? Should we talk about that?
Well, no. Well, the fundraiser just closed a few days ago. Okay. It was a roaring success. I initially my ask was just for $10,000, and you want to kind of lowball it, you know. But I was also like, dude, I'm trying to write a play. Like, who's going to care about that, you know? And it's funny because there's a wonderful libertarian podcaster and writer named Tom Woods, who really was a big. Reason for all this happening in the first place. And he was like, you know, I had a friend on my podcast who was trying to write a book, and I appealed to my audience, and he was able to raise $40,000. I'm not saying that you'll be able to get that much money, but, you know, just we'll see what happens. And I ended up raising over $140,000.
Good God damn.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
what's your timetable?
The timetable, well, the original ask was for 6 months. So 3 months of research and immersion, 3 months of writing the thing. I don't expect to have a work of genius completed in 6 months. The point is to have a draft done and to do a reading for the backers, a virtual reading and in-person reading for the backers. And then over the next, probably at least a year, because I expect to be, because it's been so successful, it's given me the leeway to say this can be my priority for an indefinite period going forward.
I'm assuming that you can't, it's not going to be a biography, and maybe you don't want to talk about it yet, but I don't imagine that his particular life would lend itself to then I did this and then I did that. And so it would be more thematic, right?
Well, you always have to think of, it's difficult because you don't want to try, you don't want to speak anything into existence at this early stage in the process. You know, Rick Rubin talks about how at the beginning of any process, he feels a ton of anxiety because you don't know what the thing is going to be. But sometimes it's easier to know what you don't want than to understand what you do want. And one thing that I don't want is for the piece to be a straight bioplay, because you can just go to Wikipedia, you know, to get the bullet points of his life. The question is, how do you create a dynamic, compelling piece of theater? Which are the more interesting and dramatically rich portions of his life? How do you arrange those events into a dramatically satisfying whole? And, you know, on top of all of that, as an actor, how do you get underneath what's going on to express, you know, whatever that might be happening in the psyche and the soul of this character? It's really, I think what's really interesting is a big part of his life has been about ideas and intellect. And the theater, as you well know, is a space where ideas and language is heavily heavily centered. So it could be a wonderful medium to debate the prevailing visions, as he might call it, of our time. But again, you have to marry that. I mean, it's like doing a Shaw play. It's very, very intellectual, and it's very speech linguistically heavy, or an Oscar Wilde play.
It's but you have to figure out. Right. Yeah.
Right. You have to figure out what the passion is underneath all of that. And I have the training and the chops to do that. And I'm very confident in it. So I'm very excited about that. But again, if it's just a bioplay, if it's just an intellectual exercise, it's not gonna be compelling. And what I also want to do, which I think will be great, and what I'm really looking forward to, is touring the show around the country in the way that stand-up comedians do. Because you don't know what the play really is until you get it in front of an audience. They teach you how to perform the play. You can only do so much sitting at a table and, you know, and gazing at your navel in a rehearsal studio. Once you're in front of an audience, they will teach you what the show really needs to be. Where are they laughing? Where are they listening? Where are they shuffling their playbills and kind of disengaging? Where can you afford to take some time and let the words and ideas really sit with them? Where do they seem to be reacting emotionally? These kinds of things you can't figure out if you're reading over Zoom or just in a rehearsal hall. And so at the end of it, once the play is tightly honed in front of live organic people, and part of it, you know, my sort of insidious side hustle is just getting getting all of America interested and excited about theater and going to shows, and then uploading it online for everyone to see.
Yeah,
and for the world to enjoy.
Two things. You might already know this, but just I couldn't write a play at gunpoint. But if I were writing this, I would incorporate somehow that Sowell is a dedicated amateur photographer. He used to send me some of his pictures. And if it were a musical, certainly you'd have projections in the background and he would sing a song about how he's observing rather than participating, that sort of thing. I'm going to drop a very obscure reference to one of the Lesser Candor and Ebb musicals, The Happy Time. It would be kind of like that. And Robert Goulet would be singing. So that's just something to know. But also, Clifton, why did you decide to become an actor? And I don't mean you personally, but I'm listening to you talking about touring the country and doing this in front of audiences who sometimes will not be exactly forgiving. And I'm just thinking to myself, you get up and portray characters in front of people. And it's just like me asking Glenn sometimes, what would lead you to want to write a memoir? Now I'm going to ask you, I'm beginning to become a very narrow person, apparently. I just sit at home and read books and play the piano. But what makes you want to be an actor?
You know, it's very strange because I can't really answer that question. I joke that my life would have been far easier if I were one of those kids who, you know, when I was 6 years old, I saw a production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. And then I was like, oh my God, I have to do this for the rest of my life. Oh my God.
That's
like,
true.
I wish I was one of those kids. But as a straight man.
It always is that show too. Yeah.
Say what?
It always is that show too.
It's always that show. But as a straight man, I entered the theater as most straight men do, which is following a girl. I was in French class, actually, in my high school. And I dropped out, much to the chagrin of my teacher, in my third year of class. And I was chasing some girl named Danielle, who had my last name as well, in the class. I think I sort of got the idea. Like, it wasn't like there's no one in my family who's an actor or really even an artist. And I was going to be an illustrator. Like, when I was a kid, I dabbled in illustration. I was in band. I was doing short stories and poetry. So I was always an artsy-fartsy kid, but performing never crossed my mind. Then one day I drew the Far Side. Gary Larson's Far Side was a huge influence on me. And so I drew this cartoon in my art class, and it was two eggs in a boxing ring, and one had punched through the other egg. And I just wrote the caption, egg beater. So I'm like, you know, maybe, I have to be maybe 15, 16 years old. This woman walks by, and I think she was one of the—I forgot who she was, but she just looks at this you know, silly cartoon that I'd drawn, and she goes, "You need to be on TV." I don't know what it was, you know, the worst way to make a decision about what you're going to do with your life is some random school administrator telling you what to do.
Yeah.
But you know, and I was also a very shy kid. I was a military brat. My life was upheaved every 3 to 4 years, and I had to make new friends all over again. And I was very shy. But then we ended up, I got to this drama class and found that I had an aptitude for behavior, for mimicry. I'd always been a class clown, so I kind of knew what was funny and what was not. Then ultimately, when college time came around, it was just cheaper to go to theater school in state than to go to the Savannah College of Art and Design, which is where I thought I was going to go. But I was also kind of a weirdo, and I started, and I was 17 when I went to college, and that was pretty much the first time where I began to get very, very, very positive feedback.
What year are we in when you're 17?
This was 2000.
Okay.
And I started doing shows and getting cast in shows. In my first year of undergrad, I did a play called The Day the Bronx Died, which is a beautiful memory play set in 1968. And I'd been a class clown and kind of a goofball, but that was the first time I said, wait a minute, I can do dramatic stuff. And so it's funny to me saying all of this, that 25 years ago, I was being encouraged left and right by my peers and my teachers and mentors who were telling me, hey, if you bust your butt, if you work hard, you'll have a very long career. You have a lot of potential. And they were right about that. So it's just funny to me to see now that the industry is now self-immolating over this idea that it's a white supremacist industry. And no one has ever impeded me. No one has ever made me feel out of place. No one has ever made me feel not included until a bunch of mostly white progressives decided that I don't belong in the industry, which I think is ironic.
You have provided a beautiful transition. That's exactly where I wanted to go.
You're welcome, John.
that was good. I have been told by, for a good couple of years now, by conservatives and liberals that the theater is immolating itself because it's been taken over by a hard leftist, let's face it, woke sensibility that is driving theater companies around the country to program hectoring, hard left, woke sermonizing plays that audiences don't like, and that basically audiences are not coming back to the theater after the pandemic because of this. That is a damn good story, but I wonder whether you could say, as somebody who's part of the industry, is that actually happening, or is that just something that the right and we liberals wish would happen because it makes a good story and because it's something going on with the occasional theater rather than most of them? Is there really a big sea change in the industry?
Well, there was a huge, over the past, I'd say throughout 2023, there were major, major articles, LA Times, Washington Post, New York Times, several times. Even right-wing outlets like The Federalist were reporting on this. And they were talking about how 20 to 30% of the audience has not returned post-pandemic. There were experts predicting, this is Peter Marks of The Washington Post, the theater critic in Washington, who was talking about how there were experts predicting that the industry will contract by 50% by this year. There are theaters across the country which are either truncating their seasons or closing outright. On top of that, they're now forming coalitions of theaters now, and they're demanding, I have to laugh, but they're demanding more government aid to support the arts.
Is this because of wokeness or because people stopped going to the theater because they stayed home?
This is, they claim that they're recovering from the pandemic. What is difficult about that is that other live performance fields, pro wrestling, combat sports, professional sports, bounced right back. And in some cases are doing better than ever, even with declining ratings in the case of the NBA and the NFL, right? So people are still, like Taylor Swift is breaking records right now. You know what I'm saying? Beyonce's still selling out shows, you know? So people are still, my argument is people still, even in these economic times, they still are spending money on entertainers and entertainment that they want to spend it on. They're still hungry for live performance. They're just not hungry to see the theater. So between the what I view as a histrionic pandemic response on top of the sociopolitics, that's been the 1-2 punch that has really diminished the relevance and vibrancy of the theater in the past few years.
What is the source of the conflict between you and theater personally? You're saying that people have decided that you're no good. What happened?
Well, for one,
Because you are good. And so what's the friction?
Well, the friction started in 2020. It's part of it is pandemic, part of it is politics. The irony is that in 2020, I began the first 3 months, I was totally in what I call the COVIDian cult. I mean, I was literally sanitizing my groceries and my mail, right? So if anyone wants to accuse me of being a denialist, they can't do that because my roommate literally thought I was crazy because I'd be walking around our apartment in a mask. I called it my little hazmat suit, just maniacally trying to disinfect every handle and knob in our little shoebox apartment.
I never felt that way. So you started there. Okay.
I started there. And then my mind changed over time. But my objections began, well, in 2020, all the social unrest happened. And I saw these sweeping changes in the industry that was responding. I mean, I was getting messages from these aggrieved white women that I worked with in the past who were just like, I'm so sorry about what's happening. It's all the George Floyd stuff, you know? I'm so sorry about what's happening. And I'm thinking to myself, bitch, this is racist. Like, you're sitting there assuming that your life is better than mine, that I'm suffering and in pain because I'm black.
That black people are all this one united organism. Yeah, exactly.
This is why I call progressivism socially acceptable white supremacy, because it presumes that all black people everywhere are living in fear and resentment of white people everywhere who aren't even alive anymore.
Although, of course, you and I both know that a great many black people, including ones of influence, do say that that's how we all feel, and that you or me, if we deny it, are not genuinely part of the black community. So with that white woman, I must admit I sympathize, although I'm furious that, you know, we have to deal with that phoniness and that dehumanization.
That's what's hard about it, because you know they're coming from a good place. You know they want to help. But at the same time, it's like, I don't need it. I really don't need it. I'm actually good. You know, this man's life, the tragedy of this man's life, which I'll agree is a tragedy. Like, why are you even in these circumstances in the first place? Like, what circumstances in your life led to this point? But again, this idea that I need to be condescended to. And the joke is that, you know, because of this white woman's politics, in the eyes of leftists, she's probably blacker than both of us politically, which is
That's
ironic.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, and I was getting these surveys from people, I'll name names, but like New York Stage and Film is a place I had a great relationship with. But, you know, it was like this survey about how do you feel entering white theater spaces? Now, John, I've been an actor for 20 years. Not once have I or anyone ever stepped foot onto a stage, onto a TV or film set, into a rehearsal hall and said, God damn, it's white in here. No one's ever done that. No one has ever done that. And yet in 2020, this term white theater spaces came up. And, you know, and I was getting, you know, like another one, Chautauqua. I was a member of their theater company in 2007, 2008. Had a wonderful time there. Was invited back the next year to do a one-man show I created there. And yet I get this email that's saying, we know, and I hate when progressives do this, we know that you feel you're tired. You feel excluded, and we know that you're in pain.
Excluded
from
what?
So here's a long list. Excluded from what? And the irony is, when I was there at Chautauqua, the only people that pointed out that I was one of the few black people there were all the white folks there. They were like, man, whoa. I was like, well, thanks a lot, bro. I didn't feel uncomfortable and out of place until you just said that just now. But
Clifton, what do you say about the people who would insist that that's how they feel? Which, from what I'm beginning to smell, is maybe most black people in theater these days, they would say, although I think a lot of them are just joining in with the herd because they're afraid of getting their feelings hurt. But a lot of them would say that they have felt black in these spaces and just didn't feel comfortable speaking up until 2020, that there is this coded racism that they're suffering in all sorts of ways and that it needs to be eliminated. Like, you know that you're expressing this view in public, you are rather unusual as a black actor. Why do the other ones feel so differently?
They're insecure. Look, I had the same thing, John. I felt the same way. If I can, I'll tell you a quick story about when this all changed for me. I was at Williamstown, which, you know, if you know theater, you know it's one of the prestigious. So I had the privilege of, I can't say hired because you have to pay to be there. But I was a young actor. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They have different tiers. Like, there's the stars that go there, right? I mean, at least when I was there, I'm sure it's different now. But there's the stars, and then there's the professionals, and then they have a bunch of students. And so then there was the non-equity actors, which they had culled from. Maybe culled isn't the right word, but they auditioned at all the top conservatories. You know, NYU, Juilliard, Yale, and that was their non-equity company. And then there were an army of like hundreds of interns from undergrad programs all over the country. So basically the first day that we were there, the 24 of us non-equity actors all got into this big room because we were there to audition for a series of one-act plays to be done by these four young assistant directors. And I did a monologue from a play called Before It Hits Home, which it got me into grad school, basically. And excuse me, it got to the point where people who weren't even in the room, like the artistic director, Roger Rees, the late Roger Rees, may he rest in peace, was like, you know, we're so happy to have you here. People were like, yeah, I heard about your monologue, man. That, you know, it's really astounding. And yet, the next day, when the callbacks went up, the list of callbacks went up, I was not on any of these sheets, and that would have been fine. That's the life of the actor. You spend most of your time looking for work. But none of the other Black actors, the other two Black guys, were on any of these lists. And it was galling because, you know, and like, for instance, in one play was one of the characters was a gay man. But one of the other Black guys was a gay man. But the role ended up getting cast with one of my classmates who was a straight white male. And I'm like, mm-hmm. Really? You know, we weren't right for any of these parts. Like, I'm more of a leading man kind of type. You know, Ramal was more of a portly everyman type, and Jordan, who was the gay guy, you know, this bass voice kind of fade, but not too much, but just a really unique kind of quality to him. So they can't say that any of us were alike. So anyway, long story short, there was that went on. And then on the main stage shows, I got to watch my white colleagues, you know, play sometimes multiple featured roles in these great shows, working with these great actors and directors. But meanwhile, myself and Jordan were in the ensemble of a really bad musical. And then Rama had the only speaking part among the three of us, and he was playing a butler in this Alice and Janney play. On top of all of that, Susan Laurie Parks was doing her 365 plays in 365 days around the country. Mm-hmm. For those who don't know, Susan Laurie Parks, wonderful Black playwright, and she did this series of one-act plays, 365 of them, that she was doing around the country, these short plays. And there was an administrator at Williamstown who said, you know, we don't think that Susan Laurie Parks would ever have a production here at Williamstown. And I was thinking to myself, now you talk about feeling Black. I felt Black as hell that summer because I was just like, there's no reason that I should be sitting here, you know, while these mediocre, I'm sorry, I'm just going to say, but these mediocre white colleagues are sitting here working with stars. I'm sitting here, you know, not doing anything. This is bullshit.
So sorry, you're saying this has changed? Because, you know, to tell you the truth, I'm a very theater adjacent person. And there was a part of me that flirted with doing performance in the 80s and the 90s. And there was so much of this. And I can't claim, I would never say I'm the leading man type. It's not that I think that I was going to, you know, be a star. But too often in, you know, college and also community theater circumstances, it was clear to me that the color of my skin made it so that it was highly unlikely that I would be cast as anything but the help, being in, you know, the chorus and things like that. And that it was clearly race. I remember there was a production of The Prince and the Pauper that never made it to Broadway, but I was in a kind of a pre tryout. Lord Hartford, the guy they had playing Lord Hartford, dropped out. And I'm in the chorus. And frankly, he is a sardonic character who clearly has a low voice. And I'm sitting there, and frankly, I sing well. They got one person after another stepping into that role until finally somebody realized when the third person dropped out that I might be able to halfway fake it. And the truth is, it was one of the best things I ever did, but I only got it by accident. And so I decided, no, it's just, you know, benign. Well, unthinking racism is such that I really am not going to even try to do this. And I stopped doing performance, except when it was my friends who could see me as a whole person and might cast me as something other than the help. Are you saying that that has changed? Because if so, I'm glad. And I can kind of tell that a lot of it has changed. But you're existing in a different time.
Well, but see, you said the term unthinking racism. And what I interpreted it as at the time was unthinking bias. Like, you know, people have grown up, like, they're not malicious. They've grown up in a certain way, and they're saying, oh, I have an idea in my head of what this person could be. So at worst, it's a lack of imagination.
That's what I
That's forgivable.
Yeah.
And to the extent that there is a problem or was a problem, I, in my opinion, it was mitigated by just saying, you know what? We're going to open this role. You would see casting breakdowns that would say open to any ethnicity, although they end up casting a white person anyway. But you know, but open to any ethnicity. And that was cool. It's one thing to do that versus top-down edicts. You have to have this kind of demographic makeup in your company, in your administration, yada, yada, yada. Because for me, that's what, I mean, it's like central planning for art. It's just as bad for societies as it is for art. So on one hand, that's why I feel torn, because on one hand, it's like, it's nice that people are understanding now that after decades, after decades of, you know, ACT, American Conservatory Theater, Yale Drama, Juilliard, and NYU grad, there are now dozens, if not hundreds, of actors who are not white, who can handle heightened texts and who have advanced training. And mm-hmm. so to me, and I was talking to my friend about this, you know, we got out in 2009 and it wasn't like this. It wasn't this radical or extreme when we got out. Mm-hmm. But anyway, going back to my story, you know, you mentioned you have friends that see you as a human being. And eventually over the course of the summer, so the second round of auditions came around for these one act plays. And guess who was at the top of each of these lists? And at that point, you know, and then I got cast in the lead in this really wonderful play called Hotline, which is about a suicide hotline, which is really, really funny. But it was all tainted. And I just said to myself, am I here because I'm the best person for this role? Or am I here to assuage some white progressive's guilt? And on top of that, you know, I wasn't getting laid. I was very upset that summer. And I had a classmate who was like, well, you know, your problem, Clifton, is that there's only two black girls here. Now, John, white girls been chasing me since I was 16 years old, okay? And it just, my other classmate was there and he was like, I can't believe you're saying this. So basically it was a heavy, it was, and on top of all this.
It's 1959. Wow.
Well, on top of all this, Sean, which is hilarious, I was actually being moved into, I was going into my second year of grad school, but I was being bumped up into a third year show. We were doing Gem of the Ocean, August Wilson's show. Yeah. So I'm also reading like slave narratives, you know, throughout the summer. So I was like, it was a blackity black summer.
Yeah.
And the thing about it is that, and this kind of goes into other issues for me as well, is that no one was going to say anything. You know what I mean? Like the other actors were like, oh my God, this is so messed up. And the other directors were really embarrassed. But the other guys weren't going to say anything. No one else is going to say anything. And I did. And I was like, this is wrong and messed up. But, you know, I reached a certain point where I just said, you know what, man? I am going to stop using my race as a crutch for all the things that happened in my life. And whether you're a racist KKK member or a racist white progressive, if you can't see me as a human being before you see me as my demographic, be that black or male, then that's your problem. Nothing to do with me. So that was that one degree difference. That
but how do you get away from it? How do you, because frankly, it's inescapable that you are seen as this black person who needs help as opposed to just a person, because now they feel like that's the right thing to do. So how do you get away from it? How do you, by doing one man shows, is that the idea?
You just ignore it. I mean, you know, and so, and here's the thing, you know, John, because, and Viola Davis talked about this as well. She was being interviewed by Tavis Smiley when she was nominated for The Help. And Tavis, I think, said what a lot of black people felt, which was, I'm happy you're nominated, but I'm troubled by what you're nominated for. And it was this really great exchange.
Over that film was so fucked up. I get angry thinking about the way people worked to hate that film. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, I hated that. It took me 2 days to watch that movie. I was like, dude, even the white characters in this are bad. Like,
you
this
too?
This is bad. I just didn't think it was a good movie. I didn't think
it was an offensive movie, though. A lot of people hated that she loved the children, the white children, thought that it didn't show enough of the violence, which I frankly thought it did. I thought that it was a candy cane movie. It was, you know, it wasn't deep.
Yeah.
But I didn't think that it whitewashed anything. And so many people despised it. Sorry to step on your toes. I didn't know you were.
No, I mean, because my issue, it wasn't, you know, yeah, you could say, oh, this white woman was writing about yada, yada, yada. But I was like, these characters are caricatures and they're paper thin. And this movie's ridiculous. And that was my objection to it. But but they're in this exchange. And Tavis says, you know, I'm troubled by what you're being nominated for. And this wonderful moment where Viola says, my friend Viola says, you know, that attitude, and Tavis goes, yeah, yeah. She goes, is destroying black artists. Mm. And her point, felt this as well, which is if so many black actors are stuck because they feel they have to, this concept of representation, meaning, which I feel like is kind of racist because it's like, you know, if one of us can stand in for all of us, then, you know, what's the point? But, you know, there is this unspoken idea, I think, that you have to, because you're there, you're representing the black race, you have to uphold this kind of standard. And for me, I'm like, well, that's just boring because then you have
dull. Yeah.
It's dull. You have characters that are perfect. They have no scars on their soul. Like, who wants to play a character like that? And it's boring.
And then you, the next things that people say, you're playing this noble artificial character and not a real person. But what's the what do you do? You know, you're an angry black man or you're a noble black man. There's nothing you can do right. And what's the point of that? Because eventually we all die. It just it ends up being this exercise that's joyless and useless. Yeah.
Well, do you know the work of Don Bogle, the film historian?
I was just about to say it's the Donald Bogle problem, but I thought maybe that book is getting too old. But Bogle wrote a very interesting book that probably made sense until about 1980. But after that, he was a man to whom, you know, a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And there's nothing any black person can do right. And then he did it to TV. He did a book called Primetime Blues. I did a piece on that for the New Republic about 400 years ago. And it's one of my favorite things that I ever wrote because they gave me 8,000 words. And I thought I really, really dug in. So I'm just going to give myself a plug for that. But yes, the Donald Bogle problem. Go on.
Well, that's it. You brought it up exactly. It's just, you know, what Toms, Bucks, Coons, Mulattoes, yada, yada, yada. Like,
it's right
like there's nothing you can do. If you're too angry, you're this. If you're too conciliatory or funny, you're this. And so you're trapped as an artist. And this really came to the fore for me. I was playing Caliban in D.C. And, you know, for those who don't know, Caliban is a slave. He is explicitly referred to multiple times throughout the play as a slave. He's abused and abandoned. You know, he is a slave. And when I was cast, you know, I was the guy in the room who was like, no, abuse me, sling me around the room, do whatever. Like, let's not be, I mean, my costume, John, literally had chains on it. And so we knew what we were doing. But I said at that point, I said, you know what, man, everyone else, the audience is going to bring their own baggage to the play. My obligation as an actor is to fully immerse myself in the text. And so what happened is that we had this one high school matinee, which is really funny. You know, you're up at 10 in the morning for these kids. And it was a great production, though, and they really enjoyed it, so it was fun. But there's a moment, for those who don't know the play, Caliban is a slave, and he ends up meeting these two clowns, essentially, a butler and I think actually a jester. And he's mistaken, thinking that these two clowns are going to free him from his captivity. And so he ends up worshiping them. And literally, there's a scene where he's like kissing this one guy's boot. And when we got to that scene, you know, the black kids from the public school, DC public schools, were like, oh, no, hell no. And then, you know, so I just went to town because I'm like, I'm not going to let these people sway me from my own interpretation. And kudos to the actor I was working with who wasn't apologetic about it. And what emerged is that, you know, I played the character as a human being. And that was where the dignity came from. But the thing is, I never would have been able to play the role as well as I played it if I'd been stuck the entire time in this idea of, well, what will white people think? How will they see me? What will black people think? How will they see me? And ironically, there was a woman who responded and saw the show, and she was like, I can't believe that in this major Shakespearean production, we have the two black men with speaking roles are playing slaves. Now, the thing about that is that I was playing Caliban, but the other black person in the show was playing Ferdinand, who is the Prince of Naples, a.k.a. the King of Naples. He's a fucking royal. He's literally a royal. Like, and so, and that's why you can't listen to these
people.
She can't
see it. Right.
But they're always going to complain about something. And that's why you can't pay attention to these people. So that sort of shift in mindset, I mean, I'm telling you, my relationships got better. My work got better. My life improved in every way once I let go of this idea that everyone was out to get me. You know what I mean? And I want that for everybody. But ironically, that act of self-possession and self-actualization and self-confidence is what sets me at odds with much of the progressive left at the moment, which is I find ironic.
Yeah, these things are really hard. What about but go back to the masking thing, because I find it very interesting, and a lot about the pandemic really frustrated me. But you were washing your apples. Then what happened?
Well, I mean, I always wash my apples, but
I don't.
you don't get a little rinse and that pristine New York tap water.
I do not, and I did not wash my hands any more during that time than I ever have. You know, I'm a finicky person, but no, I was not COVID
timorous the way many people were. I just thought to myself, that's not something that's going to happen to me. And it essentially hasn't. And I thought that a lot of what we were made to do was excessive. However, I also knuckled under to the superficial aspects of it because you only go around once. And so what happened with you?
Well, with me, it was just, I began asking questions, which you're not allowed to do in many sects of the left, apparently. And it was ironic because, like I said before, like it's a very New York way to start a sentence. But I was talking to my therapist about this in January. I was like, I'm in her office, which was in Chinatown. And, you know, I got a mask on and I got my gloves and everything. And I'm just like, look, there's no way. We were both like, there's no way this thing isn't here already. This is New York City. It's an international travel hub. It's here. So while everyone else was obsessed with Donald Trump's first impeachment and assuring me that it's just the flu, bruh, I was like stocking up on food and supplies. I mean, I still have some nitrile gloves from years ago that I collected from that period. I mean, literally, I spent a night it was either late January or early February, walking around Manhattan, lower Manhattan, going into every Rite Aid, CVS, Walgreens I could find, trying to find masks. They were already sold out. So I had to overpay on Amazon, like $75 for a box of 50.
What made you that afraid? That's interesting. When it happened, I thought I knew instantly. I remember actually telling my ex at the time, you know, it was before you had to put a mask on outside, which frankly got absolutely ridiculous in New York.
Ridiculous, yeah.
And as soon as Trump started talking about COVID the way he did, I remember telling my ex, now it's going to be that the way that you show that you're not a Republican is that you wear the mask all the time because Trump doesn't understand. And I remember my ex said, no, you don't have to worry about that. And she's a healthcare person. And I said, no, wait, in about 2 weeks, you will not be able to go outside in this neighborhood without the mask, without getting dirty looks. And that's exactly what happened.
That's exactly what happened.
But that's how I felt at the time. I thought, this is a serious disease, but we're being asked to go too far, including with the school closings and how long they were. But you found yourself changing your mind because of what? I read a little bit.
Well, for one, I have a friend who is more center than I am. And she sent me an op-ed from a man named John Yanides, who is a world-renowned eminent scientist. And basically, it was a Wall Street Journal op-ed that was like, this might not be as bad as we're making it out to be. Mm-hmm. And I remember at the time, John, I was so annoyed. I said, how dare you send me this? But because I respect her, I had the door open. And I said, you know, and she also sent me like something about, you know, during the H1N1 whole thing under Obama and how that was handled. So I already had this kind of door cracked open of like, maybe there's another possibility. But then over time, nothing made sense to me. You know, like our numbers were going down, but the restrictions in some places were either increasing or staying in place or increasing. There was an article in April of 2020 in the New York Times where they said, it was this sensational headline that was like, you know, the death toll surpasses 10,000 after 3,700 deaths are added to the toll. But they were presumed COVID deaths, meaning they weren't even tested. So I'm like, okay, at a time where we're trying to figure out and ascertain just how deadly this pathogen is, why are we guessing? Like, we need as accurate information as possible. That didn't make sense to me. And on top of that, you're looking at places around the world doing things differently. And achieving either worse or similar results. It was just a matter of over time saying this does not make sense. And I think my primary objections began as a bleeding heart artist. And I said, you know, we're shutting down everything that it means to be alive just for the sake of living, whatever that really means. And, you know, the face masks. And again, I was literally getting made fun of on the subway, John. For wearing masks.
You were one of those early adopters.
Right. Yeah. It was me and some middle-aged Dominican ladies up in the Heights.
I remember that time. Yeah.
You know, and you know, like there was one, I was going into a Columbus Circle actually. And this one guy was hilarious. I was wearing a mask and this guy, I love black people so much, man. He was just like, the ones that wearing the mask, they must be the ones that got it. Like, and there's a logic to that. In a sense, there's a logic to that. But, you know, I was one of the early ones, you know, even to the point where I was like working out in my mask and almost passing out. Like, I was so committed to it. But then I'm trying to figure out how to truncate this story. But it was just a series of things where, like, this doesn't make sense to me. And then I moved to Atlanta. I fled to Atlanta.
Did you feel that people should be able to do plays in, say, August of 2020 before there was a vaccine? And I'm just asking because I was kind of in the middle. I masked while inside. I got vaccines. I hated having to wear the mask outside because it was clear from a lot of studies that that wasn't necessary. The fact that we had to walk around like that for a year and a half to show that we were Democrats, I thought was absolutely absurd. It was, I shudder thinking of it now, putting that damn thing on for no reason and having my kids have to do it too. But, however, did you think people should be running around doing long days journey into night before there was a vaccine or maybe absolutely doing it in masks?
We never should have closed.
Because wouldn't the thing that have about made it, people kind of sick? This is a genuine question.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing, John. For one, there's never been a successful vaccine for any coronavirus. Like, I knew that going in. There never has been one. Second, the data that was coming out about the disease itself in the CDC, the beleaguered CDC even acknowledged that for most people, it's going to be mild to moderate at worst. Lastly, there were already doctors around the world who were coming up with treatment protocols to treat the damn thing. Because that was the thing for me. I was like, okay, no one here is talking about lifestyle improvements, especially for Black people, like losing weight. My cousin, my lefty liberal cousin in Berkeley, who has an autoimmune disorder, told me, like, yeah, I lost 60 pounds and the vaccine mandates are bullshit. You know what I mean? Like, she was responding to actual real data and you know, and not trying to force her decisions on other people. But the point is that we sort of forgot that medicine exists. And again, you mentioned Trump. As soon as he brought up hydroxychloroquine, that became, we can't talk about that. There's still a debate raging about ivermectin, you know, whether that works or not. But it wasn't just about miracle drugs. It was people who were saying, okay, this is a very complex disease. And in order to treat it, these are, you know, hit it as early as possible. And here is a combination, a series of drugs you can take, fluvoxamine, budesonide, corticosteroids, blood thinners, all kinds of things, vitamin D, zinc, you know, to support the immune system, all kinds of things that you could do to combat this disease because you're not going to be able to avoid it.
Can I ask
and
you a question?
And vaccines on top of that.
But are you saying that you decided not to do the vaccine?
Yeah, I mean, I got the disease in January, I mean, in December of 2020. And so I was like, well, why should I have to be inoculated against something that I've already caught when we have hundreds of studies now at this point about the robustness that suggest or indicate the robustness.
How bad was it when you got it?
I was out for a few days. You know, it was like, I mean, I rarely get sick. And so, like, you know, like a lot of men, I kind of bitch up when I get sick. But, you know, and I lost my sense of taste was dulled for about 2 or 3 weeks.
So you had the real thing.
So
after
yeah,
the vaccines, you know, I got it once with no symptoms. And frankly, I shouldn't say it because I'll be on my back tomorrow. But I don't get it. And I think it's partly because I refuse. I just kind of thought there's no way I'm going to be on my back like that. Just no. Something else is going to kill me. But you're saying that you actually had the real thing. And
yeah. And part of it was because I was living in Atlanta. And the thing about Atlanta and why that completely changed my view of things. For one, I mean, Andrew Cuomo gave this press conference where I said, I have to leave New York because he was like, if it saves one life, you know, you want to get it. You want to work? Go be an essential worker. Death is worse than a bad economy. Like, I was like, this man will just,
yeah.
Right. I said, I, John, I got scared because I said, this man will justify any action he takes because he's living by such a moral, rigid, narrow, rigid, narrow moral framework right now. He'll do anything. And I'm glad I left because that's what happened essentially. But I'm in Atlanta. And while in Central Park, right, in New York, people are walking around double masked, you know, on their canoes or whatever. In Atlanta, in Piedmont Park, in Midtown Atlanta, my brother threw me a Welcome to Atlanta surprise party. And we're there, like, people are, we're sharing joints. People are like, there's no one wearing masks. Kids are running around. They're playing cards. People are playing cards, sharing beers. It was a normal day, John. The gyms were still open. They were mask optional. I worked at a nightclub. The bars and nightclubs and strip joints were open. So you can get a lap dance at Magic City, but you couldn't go see a Broadway show. You know what I mean? And so that's when I was like, okay, are you telling me that having titties and fluids on me is it's less dangerous than maybe some spittle from some actor articulating it? You know, so it just, so, but going to Atlanta, coming to Atlanta, I was like, New York is ridiculous right now. And I said, you know, the show shouldn't be closing. And it was deeper than just, you know, all the medical science stuff. You know what I mean? It was like...
So, and Clifton, you're saying that the plays... I'm trying to keep an open mind. The plays should have stayed open. And we know that people would have been... The spittle would have meant that lots of people would have been coming down with it, because we saw that happening after the plays did open. But you're saying that most people weren't going to get that sick anyway. And so just we should accept that it is something that's in the population the way the flu always is. Is that what you're saying?
Essentially, yes. You know, if we were talking about something that had like a 10% or 3 or 4% infection fatality rate, which is what they were saying at first, then that's something to talk about. But this, it was very clear very early on who was most vulnerable to this and how we could treat it. And so for me, my attitude was, we're destroying not just the economy, not just our relationships, but the artists. I feel like I saw an industry full of people render themselves non-essential. And I'm saying to myself, you guys, especially in New York City, this is one of the cultural centers, meccas of the universe. This is the Broadway community. I mean, if you're in New York, when you go to New York, what's one of the first things people want to do? They want to go see a Broadway show. The arts and the performing arts specifically are in just central to the cultural identity of the city. And so to render them as non-essential, to me, was so offensive. And the fact that all these artists who have been complaining about fascism for 4 years had no problems letting the state dictate that they are not essential, and then dictate what they inject into their bodies.
Clifton, what about just what I'm imagining people are thinking, and I'm actually thinking this too. Remember the story that Danny Burstein, the truly amazing, versatile actor, New York actor, he wrote a story about what it felt like when he got COVID and he got the real thing where he felt like he was going to die. I think Mara Gay, a New York Times writer, wrote about how she felt barely able to breathe and this lasting for 2 weeks. Both of those articles where people described really going through hell getting it. You're saying that the risk of undergoing that, and this is pre-vaccine, people should have risked that because there weren't going to be enough of them to matter. You know, what about people who get COVID and they're not just having the sniffles for a few days, but they're on their back and worried that they're not going to be able to take in air? Because at the time, say 2020 and then into 21, I worried about that. Like, I could see that there was a need to do things differently, although I think we vastly exaggerated, you know, things that we were told to do. What do you say to Danny Burstein, for example, based on this?
I would say that after I got COVID, I got a really, really bad case of bronchitis, to the point where there were times where I literally couldn't breathe. I had to get an inhaler, which I'd never had before.
Yeah.
And even during the worst times of that ordeal, I said to myself, I don't want anyone anywhere to feel the way that I'm feeling right now. However, I am one person, and I would not want the world to stop functioning because of my own suffering. I wouldn't want to, you know, I mean, it goes back to cost benefit and trade-offs. What are we trading off? And I think people who wanted to choose to work should have been able to do so. People who did not want to work should have been able to choose to do so as well. I think that, you know, we can't diminish people's suffering and what they've gone through. At the same time, I also think we can't expect, you can't run away from a respiratory virus forever. And you also can't expect that, I don't think you can expect the entire world and society to to cater to your vulnerabilities, if that makes sense. It sounds cold, it sounds callous, it sounds harsh, but it's for me the trade-off between a disease which most people will be fine from, and are we going to stop everything in their tracks and destroy relationships and society and careers and the economy for our fears of a few people who might feel, who might suffer a lot from it. It's a very difficult and uncomfortable conversation, but to me, that's part of why the response was so botched anyway, because no one could have mature conversations about, you know, you're going to get this. Here's some things you can do to protect yourself, in addition to vaccines when those are available. But as I say, one monkey don't stop no show. You know, there's a world that has to keep spinning on top of all of that. So it's not, it's a classic problem of competing moral virtues, isn't it? You know, it's the freedom of choice and the freedom to do what you want to do, and also protecting others, and this aspect of public safety. And
it's complex. There are two things.
Sorry to jump in there, because that was my thing from the beginning, was that people were taking very, very broadly simplistic approaches to solving a very, very complex problem. And that was a big part of my issue with it from the very beginning.
There are two times in my life where my sense of humanity has changed, where I found that people are different from what I thought. One of them was when cell phones came in. I didn't know that most people would want to talk as much as they turned out to. It used to be that when you were walking down the street, you couldn't talk. But once there were these devices, I noticed, wow, probably most people would rather talk all day than be alone. And so I've just adjusted. I now realize what social animals we are. And then in 2020-21, and I'm still seeing this, I am surprised how many people seem to almost like wearing the mask, whether or not there's any particular danger at all. How many people did not seem to be in much of a hurry to get past the lockdown conditions, you know, canceling parties and things like that. I didn't know that so many people would be content not being able to smell the spring walking around with the mask. And I'm still trying to wrap my head around what it is about that certain kind of person. And the standard answer is, well, they might live with somebody who's elderly, they might have pre-existing conditions, sure. But there is a segment of people beyond those two categories who really don't seem to mind walking around in that mask all the time, just kind of because, and I certainly see it among some young people too. And I didn't know that that's something that people would not want to get away from. You know, having that thing on while you're in a plane, it's just, yeah, I'm perplexed. I'm not offended, but I'm perplexed. But I think you're offended. You really feel like people are knuckling under to something rather evil, right?
No, I mean, I'm not offended by it. I just think it's ridiculous and pointless and frankly cult-like. You know, at least the Mormons have the decency with their magic underwear. You can't wear them outside of sacred temples, but. You know, and you and I, you know, we're New Yorkers. We've both seen like East Asians, for instance, wearing masks for years before it was cool.
It always looked very peculiar. Right.
Yeah. Right. You know, and I'm like, they must, I mean, they live longer than I do, so they must know something I don't. You know what I mean? Maybe they're onto something. But, you know, so I don't have an issue with people making personal choices about, you know, what they feel will protect them. Although it is really, really annoying, for instance, to see perhaps like an elderly obese person wearing a ill-fitting surgical mask that doesn't even cover their body, like their, right. You know, their face. You know what I mean? I'm like, you're someone who is operating on what you've been told, but you don't have, you're not addressing the real problem. But I think for a lot of people, this is, I'm thinking out loud here, spitballing, but, you know, a difference I notice among the more left-leaning and more right-leaning people, and I preface all this by saying I don't like speaking in these generalities, and I feel like these labels now are less and less helpful than they used to be. However, for the sake of simplicity, I'll say that the right seems to respond more to strength, and the left is very comfortable with vulnerability, and I don't want to say weakness. And so I wonder if this idea that you are vulnerable and you are susceptible to attack. Is sort of ingrained into a lot of people. And so they kind of took that and ran with it. And so I'm going to do whatever I can, not just to protect myself, but also to hide. The world is scary and dangerous and all these scary fascists and right-wingers out there and white supremacists. We got to protect ourselves. I notice on the left is a tendency to for people to wear their mental illnesses sort of and character flaws as badges. And there is a logic to that in terms of like, you know, you feel like you belong because you're not the only person who's sort of damaged and hurting. But on top of all of that, you know, there was a constant propaganda campaign of saying you're going to die. And, you know, there was a great, I think it was the Brookings Institute, was it?
Clifton, I hate to say that everything you just said, that's so depressing and it's going to hurt a lot of people's feelings, but I would be lying if I did not say that I agree with you, that difference between left and right. And it is a generalization, but it's a valid one. And I think you're right. I think that is a lot of what it is. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, on top of all of that, you know, there was this Brookings, I think it was Brookings Institute that did this study that they showed that suggested that both Democrats and Republicans vastly overestimated the probability of landing in the hospital if you got the disease. I mean, but Republicans were bad, but they thought that there was like a 50% chance that you'd wind up hospitalized. The true number is anywhere between like 0 and 5%, depending on your age and other comorbidities.
Yeah, there was something. I mean, after about a year of it, I started having some conversations. I talked to somebody who was on the front lines in a major hospital who, you know, saw the worst of this. And I said, I'm not going to write about this. This is just between you and me. It's been so long now that I'm airing it. But he worked in a New York hospital. I said, have you seen anybody die who was not large or somehow severely compromised medically? Have you seen anyone die who was not that category? And he said, no. Not a single person. And then after a while, it became clear that, you know, I thought in my demographic, my upper middle class demographic, I started asking people, okay, we all know that, you know, somebody's teenager got COVID with no symptoms. Sure. We all know maybe one person who got it and was on their back for a couple of weeks. Okay, yeah. But after a while, I said, do you know anybody who's died? You know anybody who's died from COVID? And if they did, were there certain conditions? You know, such as being in your 90s or being very large or having some other disease. Do you know anybody? Right. Have any of us died? And after about a year, it was clear that no, that was extremely rare. Most of us hadn't really been sick. And yet you weren't supposed to talk about that, that a lot of the death and sickness was if you were predisposed to it already. That was considered fighting words to mention that. I still don't know anybody in my world who died.
In late 2020, the CDC put out a report. They found that over 70% of the people that were hospitalized with severe COVID were overweight or obese. Yeah. And I had this semi-viral tweet. I'm a smart ass. And I said, you know, I'm going to paraphrase, but it was something like, I think that we should mandate a body mass index of under 30 or under 25 or whatever.
Oh, you knew what you were going to get. That.
Right. Well, because here's the point. And they reacted exactly as I thought they would. Because the point was, I don't think you should be able to tell people what they should do with their bodies. And the thing is, urging people to lose weight would have objectively helped protect people from this disease. And at least based on what we know or what we found in, as far as comorbidities go. And people said that I just want fat people to die. So what I came away with that was that they missed the point about bodily autonomy. But on top of that, it was like they would rather protect fat people from words they might find offensive than protect them from what they're calling the worst pandemic in a century.
Well, Clifton, I would have to say to that it's so hard to lose weight. And it's so hard to keep it off. And remember, all this is before Ozempic, et cetera. I mean, if you lose if you are fat, to use that word these days, you know, if you lose 25 pounds, it's this almost superhuman effort. And unless you want to spend the rest of your life hungry, you're going to gain it back and more. And so is it really fair to say that people should lose weight? Nobody can lose weight and keep it off.
Well, see, John, but John, the point is, that wasn't the point that I was making. The point was about the mandates. But what I found interesting, you know, and again, I'm not someone who makes fun of people because they're fat, because you don't know what that person's past is with their relationship to food
or trauma, whatever it is. Yeah.
You know, but the point was, we are shutting down society and we're ostracizing people. And I haven't seen any public health officials say, you know what, it's probably a good idea to try and reduce your stress and improve your sleep and exercise. They close the gyms, John. Exercise, you know, and get proper nutrition. These are basic things that you can do to help protect yourself, not just against this disease, but against many other things. And these online leftists came at me and thought that I was fat shaming. And I was like, no, dude, that's like really... They're like, you know, the body mass index is not even like an accurate... I'm like, dude, I know all that. That's not the point. That's not the point that I'm making. So it's just, you know, there was no logic around any of what was going on. And my whole approach from not almost day one, because like I said, I was freaked out by it. But my whole thing was like, we should be taking a multi-pronged approach. My friend Jay Bhattacharya was one of the co-authors of the Great Barrington Declaration. You know, that was his whole thing from the day one. It was just, you know, we know who's most vulnerable. Let's use our massive resources to protect them and let everyone else live their lives like they want.
So, Clifton, you never got the vaccine.
You'd be called a eugenicist. What? Yeah.
You never got the vaccine.
No, I never got it. I never had any plans on getting it. No. And the thing is, and, you know, John, you messaged me and you were like, you know, my anti-vax position. That's the thing. There seems to be this weird kind of defect among the bourgeoisie. I'm not saying this is you, but they have some kind of cognitive impairment where they can't distinguish between moral, ethical, and scientific objections to a specific policy. They can't distinguish that from being against any and all vaccines. My position
shorthand. I don't think that you're against all vaccines.
But the problem is, it's one of these words like fascist and Nazi. I mean, it's one of the most toxic social labels, and it was used deliberately to make people shut up. And that's one thing you mentioned learning about people. I said, I've never had any opinions about vaccines. I've never been an advocate for or against them. I often joke that, look, if I'm going to a country, I'm shooting a movie, they're like, yo, you should get this vaccine for yellow fever. I'm like, I'd get it because I don't want yellow fever. It sounds pretty nasty.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? And so, but this whole thing, but because I said these mandates are coercive and unethical and anti-scientific and wrong, then I became an anti-vaxxer. And then I was lumped into people who were like, there is no virus, and who watch BitChute and Alex Jones all the time.
Yeah.
And it was so disingenuous and so dishonest. And it was used as a cudgel. And I think a lot of it in the entertainment industry, they had this idea that they were weeding out and purging a bunch of MAGA weirdos.
Yes.
And I'm like, guys, Black Americans vote over 90% Democrat, and they're the least vaxxed demographic. So what you're doing is you're niggerizing people that you don't know that you're niggerizing. With all of this. And it didn't stop shows from closing. It didn't stop outbreaks from happening. It didn't stop people from getting sick. And on top of that, and it's funny because as someone who never took the vaccine, I've been watching for the past 2 years as people who did take it and get boosted, they're sick every 5 fucking months. And meanwhile, there's this study that came out of the Cleveland Clinic, 50,000 participants, where they found that there was a relationship between the number of doses you'd had and your likelihood of testing positive. You know, I want to use my words carefully.
I didn't know that. Interesting.
There's that. There's also studies about the class switch among antibodies, the IgG antibody group, you know, and how the vaccines are impacting those. And, you know, so there's all kinds of data out there which you could use to form an argument against, like, this is not the right choice for me. But if you feel like you're in danger, then please, by all means, take care of yourself. But that kind of nuance from someone like me was just never, you know, you're demonized and dehumanized. It's ridiculous.
So, Clifton, I want to ask, and maybe you don't want to share this, but how has this affected your career? Because obviously, these are not the sorts of things one is supposed to say in your line of work. And there is a a herd mentality in a sense that someone like you is a heretic with a bad odor and must be chased away or pushed out a window. Is that going on? I hope not, but I'm kind of guessing that it must be.
No, John. So my career really began to take off in 2017. I found myself suddenly, I'm working with, being shared, fought over by Tony-winning directors, upstaging Tony Award-winning stars. I'm in workshops and readings. I'm doing TV. Like my career, like finally, it was like things have finally taken off. All this sacrifice have paid off. Yeah. Well, it's very stressful, but it's like, you know, I did my first play when I was 16 and I was around 36. And I was like, finally, after 20 years, things are really taking off. All of the good wishes are being fulfilled. And so everything stopped in 2020. And then 2021, I began getting inquiries through my management, former management, about, you know, has your client been or do they plan to get, you know, the shot or whatever. And to my manager's credit, she never pushed me. She never was aggressive about it. Other actors weren't so lucky. But eventually, you know, I mean, they held on to the mandates, John. Like Hollywood just dropped the mandates in May of last year. But even then, they're like, we're just not going to say it's the reason that we're not hiring you. And the theater took an extra 2 months to drop their vaccine mandates. And this was over a year after the CDC even acknowledged that, like, there's no point in treating people differently who got the vaccine and who didn't. I called it a cult. It was the COVIDian cult. And when you're in the entertainment industry, you know, it's very, very relationship heavy and reputation heavy. So at a certain level, like everyone is, not everyone, but most people are really, really good and they deserve to be where they are. And it's just like, what are your relationships? Who do you know? Who's going to hire you? You know, do they like you? Are you likable? Yada, yada, yada. So no one is ever going to say anything that could be coded as right wing, even if it's something as simple as, well, humans are a sexually dimorphic species. and I don't think that white people are the cause of all my problems. Like if you say any of these kinds of things, you really run the risk of suffering from professional damage. And there's tons of cultural workers across the country who are terrified and don't say anything. And it's not that they're hard right. I mean, they might be as simple as something as understanding economics and not being a Democrat. They will not, especially since Trump. I mean, Trump just completely destroyed people's mental faculties.
Yes.
And COVID made it even worse.
Yes.
And, you know, so now you can't say anything. And so now I have no management, no representation. I presume I've been blacklisted. I still have some people here and there who reach out to me with certain things. I may be in New York in a couple of weeks on something. But as far as I know, I just don't have a career anymore. You know, I basically am not in the industry and, you know, and it's just, part of the last few years has been, trying to get past, the intense amount of bitterness about it. I mean, I can't watch anything that was made or produced after 2020.
Wow.
Because I see a bunch of people who in my mind are complicit against, it's a bunch of people who normalized a two-tiered society. And I have a huge, huge problem with that. And no one has acknowledged it. No one has said this was the wrong thing to do. And that tells me that if such a thing were to happen again, they would do it all over again.
They would.
You know, and part of my objection to all this stuff in the first place was about precedent. Because we learn how to treat viruses. We learn how to evolve and we live with them. And we do lose people. And it's very, very unfortunate. And no one wants that. At the same time, though, once you allow the state and the government to exercise this kind of power, you've now given them the green light to do it again anytime that they want. And that was a big issue for me as well. I said, you know, well, they can just say that, you know, this year they can say that there's this bird flu going around. And so now we have to lock everything down. Yada, yada. And people say that, you know, we're not going to shut down again. People won't fall for it again. But, you know, I'm not so sure about that. I'm just not so sure about that.
Especially because a lot of people would, in a way, enjoy it. That's another hard aspect to it. Yeah.
Well, there was there's a book I just found, Politics of Ponerology, which I can't wait to dive into. Ponerology is the study of evil. And I think one of the things that I've discovered over the past couple of years particularly with regard to how we've treated children, is that people, their empathy can be weaponized to a vicious, vicious extent. And that if people believe that they're doing, people can do all the wrong things if they think they're doing them from the right reasons. And that was very eye-opening to me. And to see people whom you've known for decades just cut you off and be unable to hear what you're saying, even if it's reasonable. It's just, you know. And on top of all of that, it's artists. I said, I thought that we were the people who were advocates for freedom and advocates, you know, against authority. I mean, you spent 4 years, for God's sakes, talking about fascism and authoritarianism and hashtag resisting. And yet now the state comes in and dictates who you can hang out with, what you wear on your face, what you put into your body that you can and can't work. And even in New York, I mean, they're setting up checkpoints and curfews and lines for you to inform on your neighbors. And so I said, you know, I mean, they, people don't talk about this, but they banned protesting in New York. Bill de Blasio, whom I've never met anyone who claims to have voted for him, but Bill de Blasio banned protests. And no one talked about it but even though what sparked the ban was this LGBT activist group. They were protesting this makeshift church in Central Park. And I think there was a medical official who actually had to speak up and say, no, you know, you might not like their beliefs, but they've helped and treated hundreds of people. They've helped take the burden off of us. But the point is that this LGBT group inspired this protest ban. And then, of course, you know, if you were a BLM supporter, then you could, you know, riot then everywhere. But the point is,
They made an exception.
But the point is, why were there no quote unquote liberals, quote unquote progressives who said, no, you cannot ban our right to protest. You can't do that. Like, that was a big red flag at the beginning, you know, where people just didn't say anything. And it was, again, it's a queer rights group. You know, it was just,
I feel like I am missing in you an acknowledgement of the fact that if we're talking about 2020, 21 in particular, there were a lot of people who, as you've acknowledged, who were really scared. Like, a lot of people's response to anything we've said is, but no one knew back then, we were really afraid.
That's,
and I don't
bullshit.
Think they're not lying.
Sorry. Here's the thing. You know, and I hate this line of, like, you know, people say, oh, you're working with the benefit of hindsight. There's no way we could have known.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like I said before, I was scared, John. I was scared the first 3 months. But by April, I was already like, we can't do this forever. There's other like second order problems that are happening. At the same time, again, you had people like John Ioannidis, Jay Bhattacharya, Martin Kulldorff, and others, doctors around the world who were saying, no, we can beat this. We can treat this. We don't have to shut all this down. But they were being banned or censored or demonized. I mean, Jay Bhattacharya, he joked to me a couple of years ago. He said, you know, I knew things were turning around when the death threat stopped. You know? So there's this line that's happening right now where they say, well, we just didn't know. And now we're learning the scope of the damage. Like, no, people were telling you that if you close down schools, it's going to have a negative effect on children's development and their emotional well-being.
Which was not difficult to guess at the time. Right. Yeah.
Wow. Rocket science. And now, you know, now the Atlantic or whatever, New York Times, no offense, wants to be like, well, now here we are. Like, we can't believe. I'm like, no, we were telling you, but you called us granny killers. You called us fascists. You called us eugenicists. You called us white supremacists. You censored us from YouTube and Twitter and all these other outlets. You didn't want to hear what we had to say. And now 3 years later, you're coming back and you're saying, well, we didn't know and we were scared. I was scared and I figured it out. Why couldn't you?
Because to knuckle under was the way that you showed that you didn't like Donald Trump. And now here we are.
And that's the most incredible thing, John, that I saw was we have prominent Democrats from America's mayor, America's governor, a.k.a. Andrew disgraced, I like titties Cuomo, to our current president and vice president, who are all saying, I'm not taking any vaccine from the Trump administration. Is it safe? You know, has it been tested? Yada, yada, yada. And then as soon as power changes hands, you got to take this or you can't, or you're a second class citizen. And I was like, that You know that makes no sense. So the vaccine is dangerous when Trump is administering it. And if you want to get out of this pandemic, shouldn't you be thanking Trump? I mean, he has supporters now who don't want to vote for him because he keeps talking about, you know, I developed the vaccine and yada, yada. You know, I mean, he's a narcissist. You know, he's always like bragging on himself and selling. He's a salesman. He's always like, this is what I did. So shouldn't you be praising him? But no, they were saying this is dangerous. And then Biden gets into office and it's like, no, now take this. And so I'm like, dude, there's nothing scientific about this. There's nothing. It's political. It's a moral panic. You know, I don't want to reduce it to that because obviously there was a real danger. But at the same time, the fact that they got people at 7 p.m. every day to clap for people they don't know. And I said, this is really cult-like and weird. I know why you're doing it.
That. Oh, come on. That would be great. I love that. I used to get my girls and we would make noise out the window. And we were at the epicenter. You know, we're in Jackson Heights. And so we're listening to sirens all day. You even thought that was an act, that was phony?
It was weird, dude. Like, dude, send the people in your family like a card, like tell them like you appreciate them. But the fact that we're all going to get together and just, you know,
and applaud the workers
every day at 7 p.m.
I
found that to be a bit, especially with the lockdown, ritualistic and strange.
It was a bonding experience. And I was thankful to the health workers because we both agree a lot of people were dying. And yeah, you are better at approaching that whole thing with pure logic than I am. That entire couple of years. Because
I don't think it was pure logic. I mean, I think a part of it was just instinct as well and being kind of weirded out. And I think it kind of ties back into the into Thomas Sowell of, you know, at the end of his memoir, he talks about how the souls all kind of march to the beat of their own drum. There's this great anecdote where a brother of his, I think, is trying to figure out like who was at some family gathering, is trying to figure out like which one was his nephew. And there was a kid playing by himself and he was like, I knew that was your nephew. The souls are always off doing their own thing. And maybe that's what attracted me to people like him, because, you know, he's someone who just, they march to the beat of their own drum and take stands which are not popular, but to them at least, you know, this is the way. But I think to me, it was just, you know, I've been a lone wolf and a loner in many ways, in many aspects of my life. And this, the clapping ritual, I think for me was another aspect of, I feel like I'm watching people. I mean, part of it, maybe I'm just being contrarian for contrary sake.
You are on this a little bit, I think.
A little bit. That's fair. But I just thought it was so weird, man. It was just so weird and eerie. And it's one thing to want to celebrate people who are doing the work, but the way that it was expressed, I just thought it was very bizarre. I said, this is weird, bro. I'm not doing this.
You know, I get you on the whole lone wolf thing. There was a lunch in Palo Alto in 2001. And at that lunch were Thomas Sowell, Shelby Steele, Walter Williams, Larry Elder, and me, for the record. I was the new kid on the block. And the thing that I noticed, it was a very strong current in that room. The idea was we were going to keep on having these meetings. And I thought, this is never going to happen again, because all of us are very friendly. We're happy to see each other. But we're all loners in that sense. We're all people who sit and write in a corner. We're not joiners. And so this is not going to become a thing. And it didn't. And, you know, there was no bad blood, but I knew I better think of this as a historical moment because it will never happen again. You seem to be of that stripe. And it means you can think for yourself, but it does mean that you're going to have herds and herds of people despising you. And one has to learn how to handle it. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny too, because as an actor, I mean, one of the worst things is, you know, we want to be liked. I mean, there's that classic line in Chicago, right? Yeah. Of you know, we're all here because our mothers didn't hug us enough.
Yeah.
And so that, and I think what people don't understand about artists and the space that I find myself in now is that our skin is still pretty thin. My skin is still pretty thin. I mean, that's why I became an actor, is because, you know, I'm a sensitive guy. And it's not fun to have this abuse heaped on you and to be slandered in this way. But at the same time, I think one of the good things that's come out of the past few years has been finding my spine and just being like, this is not okay. I'm going to say what I believe. And I think this is true. And I don't give a damn if you like it or not.
But and you have to really not give a damn.
You have to, and I still do, but I have to, you know, train myself not to. But what's hard about it is that, and again, this is another one of these lessons I've learned from people that you mentioned over the last few years, is that most people just, they want to be comfortable, and they want to cling to safety and their comfort, the comfort of their lives. I mean, you know, when you talk about
the comfort of group membership, most people need that. Yeah.
Right. Belonging, validation, these kinds of things, acceptance. And because, you know, I'm a bit of a loner, I think I have less pressures in some way than others do, or obligations. But one thing that I've been very disheartened by, and this comes from, you know, and maybe you found this too in your private conversations, people, when you get them one-on-one, and sure, it's selection bias, you know, our own circle, they're far more sensible. But then on a group level, it's like, you know, we're still going to wear these masks. You know, we're still shutting down and closing schools, but we're just going to kind of go along with the flow.
If you're somebody like us, you're constantly confronted with that you have one-on-one conversations where a person says that they largely agree with you or at least halfway agree with you, but they're never going to show that in public. And so you realize there's a rot underneath the externals. Yes, that's just right. The way it is.
And to me, you know, I could be accused definitely of going down like conspiracy rabbit holes for 2020, 2021, because it was just so confusing and like who knew what happened. And I own up to that. But at the end of the day, I said, you know what, especially thinking as an actor, you don't need to have any kind of grand conspiracy theory to explain what's going on. All you have to do is look at human motivation and how people behave. If you're in an institution where someone like an Anthony Fauci is controlling your funding, are you going to say anything untoward about him if he's controlling your money? Of course not. You're going to look the other way, you know, and if you say anything, then what might happen to you? You can lose your job. There goes your mortgage. There goes your marriage. There goes your kids to college. You know, so there's all these kinds of things in place where you don't need some kind of grand scheme.
No.
It's people behaving the way that they do. And that's why we, you know, they turn a blind eye to corruption, to wrongdoing. They don't say anything because it's easier to not say anything.
Especially, and even, it doesn't always have to be about salary and position, just social opprobrium. Being jumped and called a name makes most people cry, or at least cry inside. It hurts. And you only go around once. Most people would just rather have a bit of mendacity because that makes it easier. They have groceries to buy. They want to watch Succession. And that's what, right. That's most people. And then there's some sick people like Glenn and me and apparently you, where you are able to tolerate being called these names because you know that you're goddamn right. But that is not a normal condition. That's the thing.
There's been times I've literally been in tears because I said, I wish that I were different. Like, you know, at Williamstown, I was like, why is no one saying anything about this?
Yeah.
This is so bizarre to me. You know, but I realized that most people just won't say anything. And for me, like I left Facebook many years ago and I'm only on it now so I can have an Instagram account. And even then I check both very rarely, occasionally. But I just got tired of arguing with people on Facebook. And so I left, but I found that, you know, I physically am unable to shut up about these kinds of things. If I see something wrong, I have to say it. I don't know, I think about it, like my life could have been so much, I could be in movies and on Broadway right now. There's no reason I couldn't be there right now. But you know, I opened my damn fool mouth and, you know,
you could have been in Joe popular. Turner's Come and Gone. You could have been in that.
You know, I mean, they're doing Othello on Broadway. They're doing Romeo and Juliet. I mean, you know, Michael Cassio, Mercutio. I mean, there's all kinds of things. And I try not to, you know, a friend sent me the other day, I guess they're doing Our Town. And I just said, stop sending me this because it just makes me angry.
And I was going to say, you could be in anything these days because casting has opened up so much. It's not the August Wilson. There are all sorts of plays that you should be in right now.
Well, you know, but then it's I just don't want to, like, it's tough for me because, I mean, A, I don't even have reps anymore. So, I mean, how am I going to get into any of that? But then I have to work with people who I know wouldn't piss on me if I were on fire. And not because, you know, I'm walking around, you know, talking about make America great again. It's simply because, yeah, it's because I consider myself to be actually a liberal and these people are not. And they wanted me to be a second class citizen for 2 years and they're not acknowledging it. And I also, I mean, this is a whole other podcast because I just feel like, you know, there's so much mismanagement and so much ideological capture that's part of the problem as well. So what kind of industry would I be re-entering into? You know what I mean? Like I've always had a problem just because I never had any desire to be an activist. You know what I mean? Like when I was on Broadway and I was doing The Play That Goes Wrong, you know, I'd already auditioned for Hamilton a million times. They all know who I am. You know, is he Aaron Burr? Is he Washington? Is he George Mulligan? Who is this motherfucker? but the fact that I was able to do this beloved British comedy, you know, was a great challenge for me. And the thing is, I've been like the one black person or first black person in a lot of things. And I never asked for any recognition because I was just acting. And, you know, I didn't know what else I was going to do with my life. And I kept getting hired. And when I really began applying myself, my income increased by quite a great deal. So like, why, you know, and that was, and I was completely fine with that. If I could do Shakespeare and musicals the rest of my life, I would be happy. I don't need to change the world or to engineer society in any kind of way. All I want to do is work. But it feels like if you want to work now, you have to take a stand on something, especially if you're black. And I'm like, no, you know what? My stand, my reparations is doing Shakespeare and Greek plays, you know, because I never would have done them before. And I will add this one thing as well. Like the recent controversy over Romeo and Juliet, the Tom Holland Romeo and Juliet, and this poor, poor woman who has been vilified. People are saying, there was one viral tweet that said, you know, R&J in 1994, and it was like the DiCaprio and Claire Danes. And then it's like R&J in 2024, and it's Tom Holland's black girl. And I'm like, guys, colorblind casting has been standard in the theater for decades. And 10 years ago, nobody would have cared about this casting choice at all. And yet now, because people are so sensitive to these lazy race swaps, and they're not creative choices, they're political choices that are being made. And that's what people are reacting against. But now people just assume that if there's a black person in this role now, that they're there for political reasons and for cynical reasons, not because they deserve to be there. And I saw black conservatives saying it's absurd to cast black folks in Shakespeare. I'm like, really? So that means that James Earl Jones and Avery Brooks and, you know, I mean, can you imagine, you know, Angela Bassett as Lady Macbeth?
Othello, but then we should play no other role, basically.
I mean, you know, I mean, Andre Bauer played Iago in D.C. to Patrick Stewart's Othello, you know, I mean, so... You know, I mean, could you imagine Viola Davis doing some Greek tragedy? Are you kidding me? She would be unbelievable.
She would
as Medea.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, she's like the James Earl Jones of her generation, in my opinion. She has so much power and force on stage. She's unbelievable. And you're telling me now that she doesn't deserve to be. I mean, it's gotten so crazy now. People are actually, their backlash now is that black folks shouldn't be doing these things that they've been doing. But it's a backlash to, in my opinion, left-wing extremism. And,
you know, you are quite right. Clifton, we're going to pick this up again because we have reached the end of our time on that uplifting note. I want to thank you very much for coming on to Glenn's show, especially when he's not here. And you have given me a lot to think about, most of it unpleasant. And I must admit, there's a part of me that enjoys that. And so thank you for sharing your journey. And I wish you the best in everything that you're doing, but in particular with this solo play, which hopefully will earn you a Tony when it comes to Broadway.
That would be the greatest karmic retribution ever. But John, it's been a pleasure. I hope Glenn is okay. And next time we got to talk about Sondheim and show tunes and turn off your straight audience.
We definitely need to do that. That's right.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm there.
All right. You'll hear from me.
Awesome.
Thanks, Clifton.